hardball hitting with a baseball bat. Kick up your heels, kid, and leave them all flat. What does it mean to be American?
This is Democracy Optimist. Here's your host, Professor Joshua Douglas of the University of Kentucky Rosenberg College of Law.
Ranked choice voting is all the rage in election reform. Several cities use it to elect their mayor and city council. Maine and Alaska now use it for statewide elections. And Nevada voters will decide this year whether to adopt the system for its elections. But what exactly is ranked choice voting, and how did it all begin? Can it avoid the spoiler effect of a voter choosing an independent or third-party candidate instead of one of the two major party nominees? To answer those questions, we are delighted to welcome Rob Ritchie, who has fought for the reform for decades. He's the co-founder and was the director of Fair Vote, a nonpartisan organization that has promoted ranked choice voting. Rob, welcome to Democracy Optimist.
Great to be on the program. Love the title and love the theme. So let's get going.
All right. Well, great. Thank you. And yeah, the title and theme is all about hope for what our democracy can look like. And one of those things is ranked choice voting, which is a reform that really has taken the country by storm. So can you briefly explain how it works for those who are unfamiliar with the system?
Yeah, and I like the idea of hope and optimism, because in some ways that's what it's trying to inject into our elections. And there's no single reform to do that. But I think what ranked choice voting provides is an opportunity for voters to really look for candidates who really reflect what they want in a hopeful, optimistic way, and not have to worry about the calculations of viability, right? So it opens you to vote really the way you feel. And it does that by giving you both. You have one vote, but you have a vote that becomes more powerful because you have an insurance policy for your vote. Essentially, you can vote for whom you want, but if that candidate turns out not to be viable, let's say in a partisan election this November, let's say you want to vote for someone other than a Democrat or a Republican, and it's pretty unlikely that they're going to win, but they reflect what you want. Then you have a backup choice. You have a second ranking. So you have a first rank, and as the name suggests, you have a second rank. You do a second choice. You can do a third choice. Everyone gets a first choice that counts. If candidate wins over half the votes, if they get more than 50%, then they are the representative candidate who has won right off the bat. But if not, if it's like, 45 to 40 to 15, that candidate in third place is eliminated because they're in last. And then the people that voted for that person have their ballot moved to their second choice. And so their second choice becomes their vote. And so you get a head-to-head, quote unquote, instant runoff. And that change really opens up our politics to both effectively addressing the spoiler problem and really encouraging candidates to reach out and try to build majorities from wider fields of candidates.
I loved your explanation and showing how it gives voters more choices. When I describe it to my students, I often tell them to think of piles. So we have all of the ballots, you rank order your preferences, and then we put all of the first place votes in piles, and you look to see which one is the smallest, and you pick that pile up and reallocate those ballots to their second choice. And you do that over and over again in the counting until there's someone with a majority. But some people say ranked choice voting is too complicated. It's a lot simpler to just choose my favorite candidate. I don't have to make all these markings on the ballot. Just choose the one I want. Isn't that a lot simpler?
Well, in some ways, you could say it's even simpler not to vote at all, right? That would be really easy. But
not something we advocate here on Democracy Optimist.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. In fact, we should have a right to vote on in the Constitution. But the act of indicating preferences is a very natural exercise. Like, let's say you go into an ice cream store and there's, your favorite is
mint chocolate chip. That's my favorite. I use this example at the beginning of my 2019 book, Vote for Us.
Exactly. So, keep going. And it's always good with practical examples of handouts for the ice creams. But, like mint chocolate chip isn't always there. Sorry. And then, you go in, you say, okay, Darn it. Well, do you have chocolate? And then chocolate is your second choice. We do that all the time. That's essentially what ranked choice voting is. By the way, you don't get to leave with two ice cream cones. This is a one person, one vote system, but you do get to leave with an ice cream cone. And that's essentially what this is doing. And when we see this in practice, let's say New York City, which is a big, complicated electorate with a lot of voters who were born in other countries and so on, and, you know, they roll it out for mayor in the primaries in 2021. They have the highest turnout, by the way, in a Democratic mayoral primary since David Dinkins won back in the 1980s. And 99.7% of voters cast a valid first choice ballot. That's, you know, almost everybody. And about 90% ranked someone second. And that would turned out to be very meaningful because it was a big, big field for mayor. And so a lot of those votes ended up counting for a second or third choice. And, you know, they did that right from the get-go.
You know, as I talk about in my 2019 book on the chapter on ranked choice voting, the modern era of the use of it started in San Francisco in the early 2000s. And there's an individual there who went to bars and got the attention of the crowd and say, hey, everyone, let's rank order our favorite beers. How did you start in advocating for this reform even earlier than that, back in the, you know, early 90s or maybe even earlier than that?
Yeah, well, as a function of the ranked ballot, there's a couple aspects of it. I'm a big fan of proportional representation. I believe that we need to change winner-take-all elections in the United States. And I was part of an effort in Thurston County, Washington, where there's a charter commission to think about whether we should bring that to elections in Thurston County. And it was a nonpartisan elections. And in nonpartisan elections, you can't use a party-based system of proportional representation. And the sort of best system that we believe is out there, in which I came to learn way back then, this is in 1990, to accomplish the goals of a proportional system is a form of ranked choice voting, a specific form called the single transferable vote. And so I got really interested in it and I became a fan of it. And I helped start the organization Fair Vote with a goal of bringing that to the United States. But you can't use a proportional representation system for governor, for president, for all these people where just one person wins. And the ranked choice system really spoke to politics in way back in 92. Ross Perot was running for president. He ended up with almost 20% of the vote. And he, in fact, got enough votes that only a single state was won with more than half the votes in 1992. So it was a real conversation about how to handle a third party candidate. And ranked choice voting just really resonated from the get-go. And so even while we talked a lot about proportional voting and we still talk about it today and are finding ways to move that, ranked choice voting has always seemed to be more upfront for people about something we should do immediately. And I think it probably would have actually happened a lot faster if we could have addressed the voting equipment regime we have and the inertia that exists out there for kind of bringing changes administratively to our politics. But it's always spoken to people feeling like runoffs are a messy and cost too much, that primaries could be too crowded and we need something to handle multiple candidates. And of course, the spoiler problem of, you know, quote unquote problem when you have presidential candidates running in a system built for two when you have more than two of them. And, you know, in Australia, that's not a problem, but it's a big problem here in the United States because we don't have ranked choice voting.
So what are some of the other benefits besides avoiding the spoiler effect to the use of ranked choice voting?
Well, when I started, it really was that almost mechanical, hey, let's address the spoiler problem. Let's have Ross Perot be able to run for president. Let's have John Anderson. Let's have Ralph Nader, whomever, and not have this feeling of a disrupted spoiled election, kind of a mathematical solution. What I learned to appreciate and what is sort of a universal value that actually plays out the most in like local elections that are nonpartisan or primaries is that when candidates know that you as a voter not only have a first choice that matters, but there's your second and third choice might matter, you just have reasons as a candidate to engage with more people very practically, like to say, oh, you know, so you knock on the door and the person says, hey, I've already decided who my first choice is in this city council race. You say, well, I totally get that. And I actually have a lot of appreciation for that person's position on parks and recreation or whatever it is that you are kind of trying to make a connection on. And you say, and I'd really like to be your second choice. And here's, I'd like to make a case for that. Right. And so In a both simple single choice system, you just walk away from that door effectively, you know, and or you don't even reach out in the first place. And so ranked choice voting essentially really increases engagement And the byproduct of that is you find ways to look for connection more than division. Again, not in a black and white way, but just more in a creating positive incentives. And for voters to, you know, ultimately learn more about the candidates and candidates to find a way to usually when they win a nonpartisan race for mayor, they get ranked first, second, or third by 65, 70, 75% of voters. They've made some positive connection. And I think that's really good for our politics.
And so this also leads to more positive campaigns themselves, right? Candidates have less of an incentive to go negative when they're running in a ranked choice voting system.
Yeah, shockingly, you will still have consultants and candidates who will try to do what they think can win. And sometimes they will think that's going to be a negative campaign. And sometimes, you know, you will see people engage in negative politics, but you see less of it and you see incentives not to. And you can have something as big as like the U.S. House race in Alaska that Mary Peltola won in 2022. She's the first Native Alaskan to get elected to the House. It's this very wide open process that they do in Alaska where there's a lot of candidates and then it boiled down to four. And then they used ranked choice voting among those four. But Sarah Palin was a pretty polarizing person, pretty well known in Alaska, but had a pretty low ceiling of support as well. Peltola was able to win that election without a single negative ad across the whole election cycle. And that was really important to her as a Native Alaskan. It's sort of from her people's traditions are like negative politics don't really fit with them. And she was able to find a system where she could do really well win. And this isn't to elevate like Democrats over Republicans, is just promoting a certain politics where you can make an affirmative case more than one based on destruction.
Yes, we mentioned that ranked choice voting in the modern era started in San Francisco in 2002. Of course, it was actually used decades ago in places like Cincinnati, but you mentioned the voting machines kind of made it difficult to continue its use back then. So it restarted in San Francisco and it spread to some other cities. And as you mentioned, now it's being used in Alaska. It's being used in Maine. Nevada voters already voted once to adopt it. They have to approve it two elections in a row. And so that's on the ballot in 2024. What do you make of the fact that this kind of reform started in a city and now is spread to lots of other places? You mentioned New York City and then also states as well. What do you think that says about kind of democracy reform?
Well, I think one lesson, you know, there's this phrase in our politics that Justice Brandeis popularized, you know, that states are the laboratories of democracy. You know, I think that's something you and I have noticed and lifted up is that cities are really becoming the laboratories of democracy in really important ways.
Yeah, I've used the phrase test tubes of democracies. I've said if states are laboratories of democracy, then cities and towns are test tubes of democracy.
Yeah, I like that. And I think it's it was for us a practical step in that because the voting equipment regime, as I mentioned, is very sort of inert. It's very hard to bring changes to how voting equipment is used because of the whole certification process and the fact that we have for-profit vendors that are, you know, trying to get money out of running elections for us. And it just creates dynamics where it's hard to get like a statewide change. We have multiple jurisdictions with different equipment to all make the change together. But a city or a county could do that. And so it took a lot of bumps along the way to kind of get through that regime. And then as, you know, with the first big win was in Maine in 2016, statewide, but they had a unitary system of voting in Maine, hand counting or one particular vendor, that made it easier. And then it's just now getting to the point where the vendors are finally getting to do this. They're finally reacting to the market and they're creating systems that can do it. So it really had to start with cities and counties, proof of concept, administrative potential. And then now we're getting to states and it's really exciting. It's making this jump in 2024 could be a really big year for this because we not only have Alaska and Maine using it for president, right? Using it for really big elections and of course, Congress. And several states are going to vote on it on whether to pass it. And I think if we get a string of success and positive feeling about it, I think that ranked choice voting, in my optimistic spirit, believe that we could make essentially voting become ranking. Like that becomes the way we think about voting. And I think it really should, because in some ways there's always value of having an insurance for your vote or for your second and third choice. And there's always value for, you know, creating positive incentives for candidates to talk to more voters.
And there's a handful of countries that use it as well, right? So we have some experience to look at abroad where there's some successes, not only here in the U.S., but also in other places. Fair Vote has also advocated for the Fair Representation Act, a proposed federal law that's been introduced in Congress several times. Tell us a little bit about that law.
Yeah. So I mentioned earlier that I'm a fan of proportional voting, and I still believe that is essential for our politics. And that's our North Star reform at Fair Vote for what we'd like to see in Congress and essentially for legislative bodies. When you're electing more than one person, the idea of like ranked choice voting, when you're electing one person, is making as many votes as possible count to make sure you get a majority. When you're electing, say, three people, actually, you can spread the pie of votes more so that it's like more than 75% of people are guaranteed to help elect someone, and you're electing five people, that number keeps growing. And it does that by using the ranked choice ballot. And that's embodied in the Fair Representation Act, which kind of sets certain boundaries. It tries to set a nationally cohesive system. Currently, Congress has required single-member districts for all House races. That's, of course, led to a very gerrymandered regime, either intentional gerrymanders or just the fact that most parts of the country are not competitive for two parties. So this new regime would be every state that has at least three seats would have districts of at least three people. So not more members of Congress, but bigger districts. And then, you know, then we'd cap it at no more than five members per any district, keep it as on a one person, one vote ratio, use ranked choice voting within it. And then it's this proportional representation form of it. And the outcome of that system is incredibly dramatic for voting rights. You would see opportunities for people of color to naturally be able to elect candidates of choice in many, many parts of the country where it's often a challenge under the current single member district system. And for essentially depolarizing politics, you would very reliably elect the left, center, and right of every area, usually major party people, but the minor parties and independents could hold them accountable and win if the major parties don't come through. And that system also can be used in cities. So Portland, Oregon is going to roll that out in November for its city council. And we're hoping that we could really see a much greater movement toward that form of ranked choice voting in the coming decade as well.
Another example of a locality trying something out, seeing how it works, and potentially having it spread. Let me ask you a fundamental question here. Why should people vote? You know, let's say you're in a place where that doesn't use ranked choice voting. You know which presidential candidate's going to win your state. What's the point?
Well, I think it's always valuable to think about that you're doing it with other people who think like you, and essentially you're all on a team. Whether you don't all have to wear T-shirts that say, you know, I'm Team Rob Ritchie or whatever, but you are voting with people who think like you, and essentially everyone else counts on you too. Like our votes gain collective power, and that when we care about the outcome of an election, if we care about who's representing us at any level of government, when we vote, we are voting with others. And I think the more we think of this as a communitarian act, the more I think that we realize how important it is to cast your ballot.
That's great. So what's the one thing listeners can do to support democracy, whether it's, you know, ranked choice voting or the Fair Representation Act or just in general? What do you tell people is the one thing they can do to support democracy?
Well, this year, and I think in this country at this time, sort of standing up for the principle that it is important and that we care about that and we respect results, and whether you win or lose, you respect results. Obviously, for our reforms, we should think about the fact that we don't have to stay with the rules we have. We never have in this country. And I hope that all of us can sort of keep an open mind toward that goal of a more perfect union and seeing if it can be applied locally or in your state.
Rob Ritchie is the senior advisor of Fair Vote, an organization he helped to create in 1992 and still very active today in the space for ranked choice voting, the Fair Representation Act, and other democracy reforms. Check them out at fairvote.org. Rob, thanks for joining Democracy Optimist.
Great to be on the program. Thanks, Josh.
Well, Josh, I think a lot of us are really interested in some better way to go about voting, about elections. What's a good example of successful ranked choice voting?
Yeah, let's talk about how ranked choice voting works in Alaska, because a lot of people have pointed to the state's implementation as a success. First, the process begins with a nonpartisan top four primary. Candidates don't need to associate with a political party. Of course, they can state their party preference. All candidates appear on one ballot, and voters select just one candidate for each race that's in the primary. As the name of the primary implies, the top four candidates who receive the greatest number of votes for each race proceed to the general election. Ranked choice voting then applies in the general election. Voters rank their choices for each race by bubbling in their preferences in a grid-style ballot. Voters can bubble in any of the candidates as their first, second, third, or fourth choice. For example, if the candidate listed second on the list of candidates is your fourth choice, you would fill in the bubble in the fourth choice column for that candidate. There's also a fifth spot for write-in candidates. Now, importantly, you don't have to rank all candidates. You can rank just one or up to all four. The counting proceeds as we discussed with Rob Ritchie. The candidate with the fewest first-choice votes is eliminated, and the ballots that listed that candidate first have their second-choice count instead. The process repeats until one candidate has at least 50% of the votes. In this way, the winner often is seen as having more of a consensus. How did it play out in Alaska? In the 2022 general election for U.S. Senator, Lisa Murkowski earned 43% of first-choice preferences, giving her a very narrow lead in the first round. However, she expanded that lead over a fellow Republican because she was much more popular as a second choice. Murkowski was ranked first, second, or third on 62% of all ballots.
Is the concept of ranked choice voting limited to political elections, or is it used in other ways?
It's used in a lot of other scenarios. In fact, it's used in 50 jurisdictions or so in the U.S., mostly in cities, as we mentioned, Maine and Alaska. But did you know that ranked choice voting is used in other situations besides candidate elections? It's how the Academy Awards decides who wins the Oscar for Best Picture. It's also how they decide the nominees for all of their categories using a form of ranked choice voting called single transferable vote. The Academy made this change for the Best Picture winner because it was convinced that, with 10 nominees, a winner might receive only a small fraction of the vote. As a previous executive director of the Academy, Bruce Davis, said, you could really get a fragmentation to the point where a picture with 18 or 20% of the vote could win, and the board didn't want that to happen. Also, over 100 colleges and universities use ranked choice voting for their student elections. We all have second or third choices. We mentioned the ice cream example in our interview with Rob Ritchie. Ranked choice voting allows voters to express their true preferences at the ballot box.
And what is one thing we can do to support democracy?
Do you think your city or town should adopt ranked choice voting? You can visit fairvote.org to learn more about it, and then think about writing an op-ed for your local newspaper about why it makes sense. Local newspapers are often looking for well-written pieces on democracy reform, and that can open up a conversation in your community.
Thanks for joining us for this series of conversations about how elections work, about the value of your vote, and about challenges to your right and freedom to make choices at your local polling place. Find our series online at democracyoptimist.com. Joshua Douglas, writer and host. Mike Savage, executive producer. I'm Tom Martin, your series producer. Neil Kesterson, technical director and sound designer. Democracy Optimist theme song, American, by Madeline Peru. Mason Graber and Stephen Dabney, research assistants. Caitlin Douglas, graphic designer. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Democracy Optimist is a special Eastern Standard series produced by Dynamics Productions for Richmond, Kentucky-based public radio station WEKU.